Welcome to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. I'm Mike Papali, and I'm the president and founder of In a Heartbeat, a nonprofit organization with a mission to prevent death from sudden cardiac arrest. I went into sudden cardiac arrest at age 17 and have been living with heart disease for over a decade. This podcast will dissect the physical and emotional obstacles of living with heart disease and how to overcome them. I am inviting you to join me on my personal journey of living as a heart disease patient. The ultimate goal of this podcast is to help heart disease patients of all ages live a long and normal life. Welcome everyone to the next episode of A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. A Big Heart is powered by In a Heartbeat. In a Heartbeat is a nonprofit organization with the mission to prevent death from sudden cardiac arrest. This is done by donating AEDs, providing CPR and AED training, raising money for research projects, providing support to patients, and offering free ECGs to children, teens, and young adults. To learn more about In a Heartbeat, visit www.inaheartbeat.org. All right, welcome back to the next episode of A Big Heart. We have another spectacular guest this week that I'm excited to tell you about. Before I do that, I just want to thank everybody for purchasing my memoir, A Big Heart, also called A Big Heart, I should say. I truly appreciate all of your support. If you're able to leave a review on Amazon, it'd definitely be helpful. It just helps make the book a little more searchable and helps with the Amazon algorithms and ratings. So again, thank you everyone who has purchased a book. 15% of all proceeds are donated back to In a Heartbeat and will support AED donations and ECG screenings. So, by purchasing the book, you are donating to our life-saving mission with In a Heartbeat. Okay, now for our guest today, Rob Gentile. Rob has another amazing story. He is the author of a book called Quarks of Light, which is it became a number one bestseller in 13 categories on Amazon, including near-death experiences, organ transplants, and personal growth. He's got a great mindset, and I would really encourage everybody to consider purchasing the book because he has some great philosophies and thoughts and science that I've never really thought of. So and one of those you'll hear us talk about in the interview is about the relationship between the heart and the brain, which was really, really cool. I'm glad that I had the opportunity to talk to Rob and learn about his thoughts on that. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear this interview. So without further ado, here he is, special guest, Rob Gentile. All right, we now welcome on a very special guest, an author, a heart warrior, has an awesome and inspiring book, Quarks of Light, that we're going to talk about later, Rob Gentile. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
Mike, I am honored. Can't wait to get into our discussion. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I am not going to do your story any justice. So I'm not even going to introduce it. I am just going to ask you to kind of tell your heart journey, when it started, how it went, and kind of, what ended up happening with it.
You bet. Okay. So, let's go back to that that fateful night of January 26, 2016, where it all began. Actually, just to backtrack a tad, so you know a little bit more about me. Yep. So I've always taken care of myself, healthy guy, exercise, was into martial arts, the whole nine yards. So I had been cycling through like an army of doctors for about a year because there was this pain that nobody can identify. And it was kind of like I was diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome, where you have this pain that goes down both of your arms. I had this pain that ran up the back of my neck, so on and so forth. So through a lot of different tests. I had, you know, I had my heart checked, I had stress tests, I had every test you could imagine. They said I was healthy as a horse. And it was determined that I had bone spurs on my neck. And these bone spurs from sports injuries were pinching my neck. And this is where all this pain was radiating from. So I went to Pittsburgh, which is where I'm originally from. I saw this incredible doctor that does nothing but remove these bone spurs. He goes in through the front of your neck and he drills out these spurs. And it's just a one-day surgery. You stay in the hospital for a night, you go home. So I went home and I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. And 4 days later, about 11 p.m. in my bed, I had a massive heart attack. This was completely unexpected. It was an anomaly. My wife didn't know what was happening. I just started screaming in pain. And the pain was so bad that I passed out. I don't remember anything. She calls 911. I have a special needs child. She's 25, severely handicapped. She called the neighbor to come watch my daughter, Maria. These guys showed up, threw me in the ambulance. And thank God I'm only about 3 miles from the hospital where I live here in North Carolina. So on the way to the hospital, they put an EKG on me, of course, and the ambulance driver said, I think he's having a massive heart attack, but we won't know till we get him in there. So Mike, they get me into the ER and they immediately realize what's happening. They give me some blood thinners, some things to stabilize me. And they call the cardiologist who was not in the hospital at the time. So everything seemed to be cool. I'm stabilized. I'm still unconscious. I don't remember any of this. My wife is in the room with a nurse. And then I talk about this in the book. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, my wife said it was like a scene from the movie The Exorcist. It was as if somebody had grabbed me by my shirt collar and just pulled me forward with great force. I sprung forward on the gurney from my waist up. And my eyes popped wide open. I screamed out my brother-in-law's nickname, Frosty. And I fell backwards on the gurney, collapsed, and I flatlined. So out rang through the hospital code blue, and in rushed a team of doctors who began to work on me. I was dead for 20 minutes. They could not get me back. My organs were shutting down. I had an Indian doctor by the name of Dr. Patel, lovely woman who refused to give up on me. She kept on working on me, injecting epinephrine into the heart, sternal rubs, you know, defib shocks, everything she could possibly do. She obtained a slight pulse and the cardiologist arrived, did an emergency catheterization, found the blockage in my widowmaker, inserted two stents, but deep damage was already done to my heart. I went into cardiogenic shock, I was intubated, and I slipped into a 4-day coma. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all started.
Oh my gosh. I mean, out of nowhere, like you said, and so many of these incidents happen to people that are healthy and take care of themselves. And I think that's one of the big issues with heart disease is we always associate it with maybe people that don't. Right? People that aren't healthy, people that don't eat right, or people that aren't active. And heart disease affects everybody. It doesn't discriminate. Your first, you know, you remember the pain in the bed, and then eventually you got to a point where you don't remember anymore. But what was your first reaction? Like, wake up, you're in the hospital, and they tell you everything that just happened to you. Like, what is your reaction when the doctor is telling you?
Well, it was kind of like waking up in the Twilight Zone. It's kind of interesting because, so I was in this 4-day coma. Mm-hmm. My wife, I was raised Catholic. My oldest brother drove down from Pittsburgh, called a local priest. Priest came in on the second day. I was not improving, by the way, gave me my last rites. Mm-hmm. I was anointed with oil and several pediatric neurologists. And because my daughter has a world famous pediatric neurologist, a couple of neurologists came in, examined to see if I were brain dead. Mm-hmm. They couldn't tell if I was brain dead or not. So on the fourth day, the doctor that intubated me said, look, we've got to pull the tube out. If he starts breathing on his own, we'll see what we have, probably a vegetable. I started, and that was my first awareness, Mike. When they started to pull that tube out, I was coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was screaming at the nurse, which I was screaming in my head. She couldn't hear me because I was trying to tell her I'm drowning in my own saliva. So, you know, suction me. And so the tube came out and then they had sedated me again. But when I woke up, it was my cardiologist. He was the first person that I saw who was standing over me, and he's a Sikh. So he has this turban on, mm-hmm. and he's standing over me and he's shaking me and saying, "Hey, how do you feel? How do you feel?" And I remember looking up at him saying, "Oh my God, this is a really cool movie. This is like some kind of guru or something." This mm-hmm. is, and that was the first thing that I remember. And mm-hmm. then he said to me, "My name's Dr. Bajwa. I'm the doctor that put the stents in the night you had your heart attack." Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it was like, I can hear, or I should say, I could see his lips moving, and, mm-hmm. but I couldn't hear what he was saying. I went into shock. Mm-hmm. And I could smell the anesthetic around me. I could smell the hospital room, but I couldn't hear anybody. It was like a bomb went off. Mm-hmm. And I realized that something catastrophic had happened to me. And that's when my wife came in and she told me what had happened. Mm-hmm. So that was my first.
Yeah.
First experience.
And how many days were you in the hospital, you know, after that? Like, what was the recovery like once you kind of woke up and started learning what had happened?
Yeah. So as you can imagine, I was told pretty straightforward that my heart was completely destroyed. And the mm-hmm. only way that I was going to be able to survive was to get a heart transplant. So mm-hmm. my ejection fraction was under, I think it was like 9% or something, just barely enough to, you know, to keep me alive. So I was in the hospital, I think, for 10 days. And then they transferred me to a rehab facility where I began to have congestive heart failure. Mm-hmm. I was making a little bit of progress in the rehab facility, but again, along comes congestive heart failure. And it was really, really spooky. Everything started to swell up my legs and ankles. So they were very good there. They were able to give me a lot of medicines to get the water off of me. But then what they had done, they transferred me to another hospital in Charlotte, Mike. And that's when they fitted me with a defib vest that I had to wear around the clock. And they put a port in my chest. And they were dripping Milrinone on my heart like every 90 seconds or something. So I looked like this cyborg creature, right? That I had I had a battery pack slung over my right shoulder for the defib vest, and I had a battery pack slung over my left shoulder to run the pump for the port to squirt the Milrinone on my heart. And my doctor was like, you know, think of Milrinone as STP for the heart. It makes the heart pump faster, but it also starts the clock ticking. So he said, you're going to start running out of time. So that's when I call it seeking a new heart in the book. That's the chapter of trying to get a new heart. And I'll tell you, it's a scary thing getting into that world of organ transplant, because there aren't many hearts, unfortunately. You would think that there would be, even though the donor awareness has really been raised in this country. But it's very, very difficult to get a heart. Mm-hmm. So I went to Duke University here, Sanger Heart Clinic, all wonderful institutions. Nobody would give me a heart. They wanted to put me in the LVAD, which I researched the LVAD, and I found out that less than 30% of heart transplant patients ever get a heart once they get into the LVAD, because the LVAD produces a lot of issues. You get strokes, infection in the body, because, you know, the wires are coming out your body. So the quest for a heart began, and I really got lucky because the owner of my company, which I work for a steel company based out of Chicago, I didn't know at the time, but we're a privately held company, and he's a philanthropist, and he donates quite a bit of money to the University of Chicago Medicine and sits on the board. So he actually was able to get me to the University of Chicago. And that's where part two of my journey began. But that was, I was admitted into the University of Chicago Medicine on April 20th.
Okay.
So I died on January 26th, got admitted to UChicago on April 20th. And that's where the transplant testing began.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I made medical history, because I wasn't going to make it very long. And I had an incredible doctor, an Indian doctor by the name of Dr. Juvanandan, who had been working on a heart pump.
Mm-hmm.
It's a counter pulsation device, and it's called the New Pulse. And he came to me and he said, I've got this incredible new heart pump that I've been working on for a long time. He said, it'll be a bridge to transplant. And he said, it's really kind of cool. He said, because I'll put this small cut right above your left breast. I'll fish this tiny skinny balloon down through your aorta, and these wires will come out the side of your body tied to an iPad. And this, you know, this heart pump is about the size of a lunchbox, and you can walk around with it and exercise so you don't atrophy while you wait for your donor heart to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow, doc, that's the coolest thing. I said, tell me, how many people have had this thing? And he said, well, that's it. He said, we've tested this thing on pigs and cows. And I said, oh, cows, you know, like where steaks come from. And he said, yeah. He said, but we did have it in one guy who was going to die. We had no choice but to try it on him, but he only had it in for, I think it was 36 hours. And then his donor heart showed up. But he said, we need 3 weeks of data before we could take this thing to the FDA for trials. So I asked him, I said, well, how many people do you think this could help if it works? And he said, if it works, we're going to change the history of cardiac care together. Wow. And you know what, Mike? Best decision I ever made. I signed the papers.
Yeah.
The surgery was 12 hours long, strapped down, you know, very, very strange position to get this thing put in me. But it was phenomenal, a phenomenal medical device, which, by the way, now I think is in 30 or so hospitals across the country, been saving a lot of lives. And people are actually able to go home and wait for their donor heart instead of waiting in the hospital with mm-hmm. the New Pulse. So mm-hmm. very, very cool.
That's awesome. And that was going to be my question. So you had the surgery, but you, when it happened with you, were you able to go home and wait, or were you in the hospital while you were waiting for a transplant?
Yeah. So I'm in Chicago.
Yep.
And since I was the first guy to ever have this New Pulse for that long a period of time, of course, I couldn't leave the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That was the end game, that if it worked and they yep. could tweak it, that, you know, potential transplants can go home and wait for the donor heart. But yep. that wasn't one of them, of course. Yep. And I lived in North Carolina, so I had to stay in the hospital.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Donor heart. Yeah. I'm curious to hear about like the mindset of waiting. Because there's a period there where you're basically waiting for the doctor to come in one day and say, we have a heart. And I spent some time in the hospital, not nearly as much time as you have. And there's no way to say other than it stinks. It's just not you know, it's not home. It's not freedom. It's not, you know, doing what you want. The food stinks, right? It's just like not a good, great experience. So
right.
I'm just curious to kind of hear like the mindset of, it's got to be like a daily battle of, you got to stay positive, right? Because you just have to have a positive mindset when you're going through these things. But there also has to be a point of like, man, is this ever going to happen, right? Like you must feel some days where you're like, you know, what if it never happens? So kind of curious to hear what that mental battle was like.
Man, that is a great question that yeah. not many people have asked me, and I'm glad you yeah. did, because it's so important. The mindset and a positive attitude and all these things. And by the way, because I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who potentially might want to read the book,
mm-hmm.
because there were other health challenges that mm-hmm. they found through the testing process that came up as well. So I'll tell you, I pulled out all the stops in terms of mental attitude, relying on my faith a lot, you know, reading scripture every day. But one of the cool things that I did, Mike, and this is something that even my doctors now say, man, you don't even know it, but you developed kind of like this new curriculum in the hospital, because the doctors would come in and they would just like kind of shake their heads and they would just laugh and walk out of my room, right? So what I would do is I found that music was a big part of keeping my spirits up. You know, my wife, my daughter obviously can't travel. She's severely handicapped. My wife can only come up every once in a while to see me because she's at home caring for my daughter. Plus she's a pharmacist, has to work. So what I did was, and since exercise had always been a part of my life, and as we all know from all the Harvard studies now, exercise is really more for the brain than it is the body, because it releases such incredible chemicals and it's just, you know, a marvelous thing. So I developed this exercise routine in the hospital where I went down to where the physical therapists were. I got some stretch bands and I would do certain reps. Like some days I would do standing wall pushups, because the New Pulse, if you can imagine, I've got this thing strapped over my, the battery pack strapped over my side. And then I've got these wires hanging out of me, and I could hold that thing either on my shoulder or I could put it on an IV pole. So I put the thing on an IV pole, the pump, and I would stand up, lean up against the wall, and I would do wall pushups because obviously I couldn't get down on my hands and knees, and I didn't have the strength because my muscles began to atrophy really, really quickly. When I came out of the hospital after my heart attack, and I was in that bed for, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks, mm-hmm. It's amazing how quickly the body begins to atrophy if you don't move it around. Mm-hmm. So I'd already lost a lot of muscle mass. I'm 172 pounds. Right before my donor heart came, I had wizened down to 138 pounds. So I was like a skeleton. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, my oldest brother commented, he said, you have the body of a wizened old 90-year-old man and the voice of a child. Didn't think I was going to make it. But I kept that exercise routine up, Mike. So I would do these wall push-ups. I got these stretch bands, and I would tie one of the bands to the end of the hospital bed. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed, and I would do curls. I would walk all through the cafeteria, all through the hospital, go up and down the different floors to keep myself fit. And that paid off in spades, because the stronger you are going into transplant, because the recovery is so difficult, the stronger you are going in, the better the results are going to be coming out, because you're going to need every ounce of strength mm-hmm. once you get that heart put in you. Because man, I'll tell you what, that first week, it's something.
Yeah. And we're going to talk, I have one more mindset question that just popped in my head though. Kind of before you go into you have the surgery. So you find out one day that, I'd imagine the doctor comes in, has great news, right? We found you a heart. I'm just curious to, because I'm imagining the kind of mixed feelings here. Obviously there's this giant sense of relief, right? This is the news you've been waiting for, I think in your case, it had to be close to 2 months. But this isn't a simple surgery. It's not like the most routine surgery in the world. So there's got to be some fear involved, right? It's like, okay, this is the greatest news I've ever heard, but I also know that in a day or two or whatever, how long, I'm going in for like a pretty intense surgery. And, you know, all surgery can be fearful. This one in particular is intense. So I'm kind of curious to hear about that feeling. It's, you know, it's got to be a balance of good and bad.
No question, because actually had to, and maybe some of your listeners have gone through heart transplant. So you have to sign documents, of mm-hmm. course, before, once they know that the heart is available, you have to sign these documents that, hey, if anything happens, you know, they're relieved of all responsibility. Because a lot of times what people don't know, Mike, and they told me this on the front end, the heart may show up bruised. The heart may show up and they find that there's something not right with it. Because you have to remember, the heart can only live outside the body for 4 hours. So when the doctor shows up to get the heart, they put it in ice. I mean, in a cooler. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things can happen to that heart in transport. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they told me was, okay, we're going to knock you out, and we're going to cut you open, but when we go to put that heart in, if something's wrong with it, guess what? We're going to sew you back up and bring you back up to your room. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it. And those are hard things to get your head around. But I think what happens in these situations, at least in my case, and I was in the hospital for 6 months. So from January 26th, I didn't get my heart until June 6th is when I was transplanted. Mm-hmm. You're saying to yourself, you know what? I want this to end either way. Sure, you want to live, but you get to a point, your psyche, your mind, your spirit accepts the fact that, okay, you're at this crossroads now. This is what you've been waiting for. And you have to accept the fact that it might not turn out the way you want it. And of course, that's where you rely on your faith. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing you can rely on.
Yeah. I can imagine. Okay, so June 6th, I know we shared this. This is also my birthday, so I'll never forget. I'll never forget the date of your heart transplant. But
that's right, D-Day.
Yeah, D-Day, right? A lot of great stuff happened on June.
Yeah.
So you have the surgery, and you know, I can't even imagine. Like you said, the next week, the next month, next couple months. I just love to hear a little bit about the recovery, what it was like. You wake up and, you know, the struggles, the good, the bad, what kind of came with recovering from a heart transplant?
Yeah, I could tell you that I have never known pain like that. Mm-hmm. When you come out of heart transplant, there's a period where, and it's a curious phenomenon. Obviously, when your birth heart is cut out of you, mm-hmm. and you get somebody else's heart, there's a phenomenon known as SAG. And what that phenomenon is that because the heart has a brain, and we'll get into that later,
yep.
the heart knows that it's not in its own body. And this is scientifically proven. All of my heart transplant surgeons, you know, they came in and talked to me about this. So the heart knows, the donor heart knows that it's not in its own body. So you know what it says? I'm not gonna be in here. I don't know who this is. Mm-hmm. So they have to give it medicine to jumpstart it and to make it beat. So it begins to become familiar with its own environment, with this new environment. Okay. Yep. So that in itself. When I came out of heart transplant, to feel another human being's heart beating inside you and have the essence of another human being inside you is the most fantastical thing that I've ever experienced in my life. Mm-hmm. And that heart was beating so strong compared to my damaged heart that it felt like I had to hold on to the rails of the bed every time the heart would beat. Mm-hmm. It was like really cool, this rhythm that was going on. And all of that was fascinating to me until they had to move me. And when they moved me they brought me out of intensive care. And for those first 4 days, you feel like a cat in a bag because you're on morphine, you're on all these drugs but you know, you have this awareness of what's going on. And it's like you want to just crawl out of your skin, but you can't. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're in a straitjacket. But then they move you, you know, back into your room. And that's where they had to transfer me out of the ICU bed into a regular hospital bed. And the way they do that is they get some big nurses and they put the beds together and they take your sheet and they try to slide you as gingerly as possible across to the other bed. And that's the first time that I ever knew pain like that in my life. I couldn't breathe. Mm-hmm. They took my breath away when they moved me. So once that settled down, my doctor came in and he said, okay, now that you've caught your breath, it's time to get up. And I said, get up? Are you out of your mind? I'm not going anywhere. And he said, oh yeah, you're going to walk right now. So it's now that I got to tell you, Mike, I had a physical therapist on each side. You got these four huge drainage tubes sticking out of your belly. that go into a tank, and all this equipment that they're holding, and you take your first steps. Now that is something I hope I never have to go through again as long as I live. I can't explain that kind of pain. But, you know, I understand why they do that, because then the next day it gets a little bit easier, and the next day it gets a little bit easier. And you have this attitude of gratitude then that, hey, you know, you've made it through the toughest part, and now it's all uphill. Mm-hmm. It's all uphill from here, and in terms of those first 2 weeks, and then it's downhill. You start to feel better. But you know, you're on a lot of steroids, you get puffy, all of these things, you have to battle all of these things that are going on. And then the first, particularly the first 3 months after transplant, the daily testing is difficult. It's a difficult process. They have to do what they call a right heart cath. They punch a hole in your neck and they go down through your vein into your heart. You feel them fishing this tube down, and they take biopsies of the heart to make sure that it's not rejected. Mm-hmm. So it's a long process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had to live near the hospital. I had to get an apartment in Chicago. You have to live near the hospital for a year after transplant. They're responsible for you for 1 year, because if you do have a rejection or infection and you lose the heart or you die, then they can lose their transplant license. So it's sticky.
All right. You used a word in there that I want to touch on, and it's attitude, because you know, one of the purposes of the podcast here is to help heart disease patients live long and normal lives, and we talked about this before, but that in my opinion is not possible without a certain attitude. And you know, I'm looking at you now and I see the stuff that you've done, and I'm sure you have some limitations, maybe some things that you can't do, but you've gotten yourself to a point where you're living a fulfilled and a good life. You know, I just kind of want to talk about that attitude that helped you get from, I mean, 6 months in the hospital, heart transplant to where you are now.
Yeah, great question. I think that, you know, and I had a near-death experience, that's part of the book, I won't get into that, but, and you realize that when you have that kind of brush with death, and you realize that the days that you have ahead of you are the only thing that matters. Mm-hmm. Nothing else matters. The past is the past, you can't change it. Whether, you know, if you have heart disease from bad eating habits or poor lifestyle, whatever, you can't change that. That's gone. It's water under the bridge. But when you go through what I went through, and you know that every day ahead of you is what counts the most, mm-hmm. you keep that mindset and you keep that positive attitude. And I got to tell you, man, I'm going to make you laugh, because the Rocky franchise, you know, the Rocky movies,
yep.
Sylvester Stallone movies, were always a big inspiration for me, right? I'm from Pennsylvania, steel town, you know, that thing was filmed in Philadelphia. But when I was living in that apartment by myself in Chicago, Mike, after a heart transplant, I would do everything that I could to keep myself inspired. Mm-hmm. I would put Rocky movies on, you know, all kind of movies that where people face enormous challenges and rise above themselves. And so I would do that. My faith was a big part of that, staying inspired that way. So there's an eating right. And of course, you know, getting back to my family, getting back to my special needs daughter, mm-hmm. being able to help her through the rest of her life and helping my wife now. So all of those things, man, are just so important for us to remember. Everybody has something in their life that they cherish. And I would encourage your listeners to tap into whatever that is. If you don't want to do it for yourself, man, do it for them, because listen, it our lives matter. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like feeling healthy and strong and good again. And even as a transplant, sure, I have limitations. I'm on immune suppressants the rest of my life. You know, they drain the magnesium from my body. Sometimes I have horrible cramps. I have to take a lot of magnesium supplements. I can't build muscle the way I used to build it. Hey, man, it's all good, mm-hmm. because every morning I get out there, I do a fast-paced 2-mile walk. I come home, I do a little bit of yoga, some light weights. And these things really keep my mind and my energy positive and my mind in the right positive direction. And I keep myself, you can't see all of my office here, but I keep myself surrounded with very positive aphorisms and inspirational books, plants, nature, all those things that really go into enjoying life and being human.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. And I think what I'm taking from it is a lot of the stuff that you do, and I'm thinking about my life, and I think I do a lot of similar things. You do, it's not about, this person or that person, where I guess what I'm getting for part of my life, when I'm a competitive athlete, I'm thinking, okay, I'm competing with this person. And right now you're basically doing things that are best for you. And you've kind of figured out the things that are important to you in your life and your 2-mile walk, your yoga, the stuff in your office, that's what works for you. And it's important for people to kind of figure out, okay, what can I do in my life that's going to make me feel good? Right. And it might be a little different than it was pre heart transplant or heart disease, but it's figuring out those things that, like, yeah, of course, exercise is good physically for you, but you said it before, like that 2-mile walk and that yoga, like that's so mentally important for you, I'm sure. And that's the key, I think, because every person's a little different, but you got to kind of figure out what those things are that make you feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what makes me feel really good too? Giving back. Mm-hmm. Just like this, sharing my story. And I know that's why you started this podcast, just sharing our stories mm-hmm. to let people know that just because you have heart disease or a heart transplant or anything, it's not a death sentence. You can move forward. You can have a great life. And mm-hmm. honestly, from what I know now, Mike, and you can't change the past, but if I could, I would dare to say to you that I wouldn't change a thing.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody said to me, could you go back and if you could avoid a heart attack and heart transplant and all the things that you went through, would you change it?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to you, honestly, that I wouldn't, mm-hmm. because I have learned that it's through adversity, it's through the vicissitudes of life, it's through these things that we really find out who we are.
Yep.
As human beings. And when you rise to the occasion and you beat that adversity, it does something to your soul, does something to your being. You know that you can face anything. You mm-hmm. become stronger.
Yep.
And that's very important for us as people, as individual people, because when we hear each other's stories, these stories lift everyone up with it. Mm-hmm. We lift each other up when we can beat these challenges in our life.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's, it defines you and makes you who you are and helps you find your purpose. And I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I want to talk a little bit about your donor and what that relationship is like with your donor's family and kind of what that feeling is.
Well, I'll tell you, that is, that was an incredibly emotional and mm-hmm. beautiful experience for me, which, by the way, many, many, many transplant patients never get to meet their donor family. Mm-hmm. I was persistent.
Mm-hmm.
I was persistent because the essence of this person kept on kind of screaming at me spiritually to be found out and to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I could tell you, a lot of donor families, they don't want to make contact with the recipient because mm-hmm. emotionally they don't want to go through it again.
Yep.
And I was really lucky. I was persistent. I was able to contact my donor family. I was able to meet the mother and the father. And although I don't have the mother passed away, the father is still alive, but I have a wonderful, beautiful, blossoming relationship with my donor heart's best friend
mm-hmm.
and her mother and her best, they were best friends since they were 5 years old. So I was able to learn a lot about my donor's life through her best friend, which was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And that was a key part of the book, the relationship that I was able to develop with her friend and find out more about her and the coincidences, so-called coincidences that were just spine tingling that I learned about my donor heart and how I now believe that coincidences are just God's way of remaining anonymous. So, because I think we're all connected, we're all one.
Definitely. That's really cool. And I think this kind of leads into the next kind of topic that I want to talk about, which is something that I've learned a ton from you and your book. And honestly, I find it truly fascinating, but I want to hear your take on the relationship between the heart and the brain, because quite honestly, before you and I spoke the first time about a month ago, I had never once in my life even thought about it. So I'd love to hear, relationship between the heart and the brain.
Absolutely. I love talking about this because I didn't know anything about it either, but I got to tell you, it answers so many questions mm-hmm. about a lot of things, about intuition, about, you know, obviously many religious belief systems believe that, you know, the heart is where the soul is. I mean, they're on and on and on and on, but to take the scientific view and perspective on this is what fascinates me the most. So here's what I learned. And I mentioned to you before our podcast that I was going to send you some new information, actually. But here's what I learned. And part of this came from my doctors at the University of Chicago. Some came from my own research. But the heart has its own brain. The heart contains its own system of neurons that rival the brain, which is incredible. In fetal development, it's the heart, you see, that starts beating before the brain is even developed. That's basic physiology. So the heart is what sends more information to the brain than vice versa. Now, what's curious is that there's four ways that the heart learned to communicate with the brain. It communicates neurologically. It communicates biochemically, biophysically, which are pulse waves. And the most interesting, the most powerful way is it communicates energetically using electromagnetic fields. Now, this is what's so incredible about this. The heart is the most powerful source of electromagnetic energy in the human body. Think about that for a second. It produces the largest rhythmic electromagnetic field of any other organ, including the brain. The heart's electrical field is 60 times greater in amplitude than the electrical activity generated by the brain. Here's why this is important. You know, when we get angry and frustrated, it affects our heart. And vice versa, when we're joyful, it affects the heart. So what I learned through research is that the heart's rhythm is affected by our feelings and emotions. So emotions such as anger, frustration, anxiety, they give rise to irregular and erratic heart rhythm patterns. Very important to know. So that depletes our energy. It throws our central nervous system into chaos. In contrast, positive emotions such as, you know, appreciation, joy, love, positive thinking, they send a very different signal throughout the body. The heart rhythm pattern becomes highly ordered, like a smooth, harmonious wave. And they call this a coherent heart rhythm pattern. So when we're generating this coherent heart rhythm pattern, the body systems become synchronized, operating with efficiency and harmony. Now, when you really think about that, Mike, that's why when we talk about eating the right foods, when we talk about exercise, when we talk about taking that time to go for a walk in nature, all of these things are affecting the heart, which in turn is talking to the brain. So there's this loop that's taking place all the time in our body. And that's the role that the heart plays. And what's even more interesting is that And this is where I think that intuition comes from, some other things come from, that the heart's magnetic field, it produces this, it generates this kind of aura up to 3 feet away from the body. So it's almost like when we're with somebody, and I've, you know, in my business, I deal with people from all over the world who can't speak English. But it's amazing when you're in the presence of somebody, how you can feel it, it through body language, through in how their tone is when they speak. You can feel a person's essence. We've all experienced this in our life. And it's because of this invisible magnetic field that the heart generates around us. And they've done a lot of studies, and these are, I mean, world-renowned studies, that they'll put two couples in a room and they'll put an EKG on them with your spouse. And before you know it, those heartbeats will start to synchronize. Wow. So it's just, I mean, we can go on and on and on about this. So what I've hypothesized is that the heart is really a transmitter, mm-hmm. using invisible electromagnetic waves like a radio to communicate feelings and emotions. And the brain is like a landline, but the heart is more like a radio. So these radio waves, these invisible electronic magnetic waves are feelings and emotions, and we affect one another that way, and it affects our heart rhythm. And you know, when you think about it, it makes sense, right? You watch a video, or even in real life, of two people fighting and having an argument, and see how that makes you feel, and what it does to your heart rhythm, how it affects your blood pressure and everything else in your body, mm-hmm. versus, you know, someone playing with a puppy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's extraordinary when you think about it. So that's why, you know, caring for our heart, caring for our body, caring for the loved ones, all of these things, you know, are wrapped up in this whole thing about the heart. It's not just, I want to make it clear to everybody that it's not just this muscle in there that, you know, beats every, I don't know how many times a minute, I forget. I used to know these things, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah. Wow. It's amazing. I said, I've been totally, I don't know what the right word is, mind blown, or my eyes have been completely open to that concept ever since our discussion and reading, you know, some of the excerpts, parts of your book. So it's awesome. It's something that people really, I don't think in general really understand. So I appreciate you sharing it, because, you know, it's just for our audience and for our listeners, it's an important thing to know. And it's something that's never been talked about here. So thanks for, you know, sharing it and, you know, shining the light on it, because, you know, it definitely will help. I want to talk about the book, but before we do that, I have one kind of final heart transplant question for you. And I think it's a tough one, but if you were talking to somebody that is, you know, in any sort of heart disease scenario, first diagnosed, you know, I was just going through transplant, cardiac arrest survivor, and you could give them one piece of advice moving forward to help them with the rest of their life, what would it be? Tough one. It's tough to limit it to one thing.
Yeah. You know what? I was going to say, do I have to answer that with one?
You can, if you have more than one, we can, it's not a strict rule. So if you have more than one, you can share it.
Yeah. Cause that is definitely, I think it's a multifaceted answer.
Yeah.
Because, I think I touched on this a little bit earlier. We can't change the past,
mm-hmm.
but when something like this happens, it always puts our lives in perspective. And I would encourage someone who had something like this happen to them to take the more positive perspective from it. Because like I say, nothing you can do about it now.
Yep.
I mean, I never forget when after I had my heart attack and they sent me to rehab, I'm looking around the room and I remember how humiliating it was. You know, here I am, I'm 56 years old and they're teaching me how to, on a gym mat, how to fall properly, not to hurt myself. You know, so here I was a successful executive and now I'm reduced to this. And so we're going to have those moments where we feel sorry for ourselves and we say, man, how am I ever going to pull myself up from this and move forward? And again, how we do that is we think about the future. We think about what we can do right now. What step can I take right now in this moment to stay positive, to think about the future, to know that this is not a death sentence? And, you know, I got to tell you, it also, Mike, is a way for us to move forward in the sense that, hey, guess what? This is going to be a positive thing in my life because now I could slow down. I can enjoy things more. You know, no longer do I sit down and gobble my food. I go outside and I sit outside when I can and I'll eat my lunch and enjoy nature. I enjoy my daughter more. I enjoy life more because I know how precious it is. I know that it can change just like that. Well, in a heartbeat. Yes. So, and when we remember that and we take that attitude about what's happened to us, I think that that really puts us in a better mental state to deal with it. You know? Awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Couldn't agree more. I think it's great advice. I think it's important to move forward and just you're spot on. It sounds like a simple thing, but you can't change the past. You can only use it to help have a positive impact on your future. Course of Light. So I'm going to brag for you. It's been a number one bestseller in 13 different categories on Amazon, which is incredible. What was the inspiration to write a book? Because there's a lot of people that have gone through things in their life. Not a lot of people have written a book. So I'd imagine one day it clicked. What made you decide to do it?
Well, I got to tell you, it's two part. The first thing that I had a profound near-death experience when I died. And I had a profound experience right before my donor heart arrived when I almost died again. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to share that story because I have a severely handicapped child. And this is another thing that has come through this whole experience, and taking, you know, a negative and turning it into a positive, because I was able to, my daughter's nonverbal, but when I died and I had this near-death experience, I was able to see my daughter perfect and whole. And I was able to have a conversation with my daughter. Very personal thing. But when I asked my daughter what I could do to help her, because my wife and I have dedicated our life to her. Mm-hmm. And she told me in that spiritual realm, she said, just love me. And when she said, just love me, those three magic words, it changed my life. And I knew that after I got out of the hospital, even though it was a very difficult recovery, I went back to work full time, and writing a book is, it took me 3 years to write the book because I can only write for like 3-4 hours every morning. Mm-hmm. But I was encouraged to write it because Maria is kind of like the hero of my life. She's the one that taught me that even through severe disability, that you can have a wonderful life and you can have maybe not what you consider normal or somebody else considers normal, but you can have a normal life, a normal, fulfilling, rich life full of love. And, you know, in conjunction with that, wanting to share what Maria's taught me, and all of my doctors came to me and said, Rob, you've got an incredible story up here of overcoming adversity. You've made medical history, and I think you need to share it with the world because it'll help so many people. So that was kind of like the catalyst, Mike, and, you know, to write it. Maria and my doctor saying, I think it'll help a lot of people to share what you've gone through.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that kind of like leads into my next question, I guess. what's the purpose and what's the goal for, you know, when a reader finishes your book, what do you want them to get out of it?
Well, there's a couple of things there. I want them to understand that our real identity comes from our Creator. Mm-hmm. And once we realize that, we can accomplish anything. Once you realize you're part of the divine, you can accomplish anything. You don't have to settle for less. I want them to understand that adversity is a gift, and it helps us become more than we ever thought we could be. It introduces us to ourselves. I want them to understand that love and for people around us and the ones that we're close to in our lives and is one of the most important things that we could ever do. Love is the universal language that God speaks through all of creation, mm-hmm. and that we're all connected. We're all one. My book is about unity. It's about oneness. And it's about understanding that until we really get that concept that we're all one, mm-hmm. it's the only way we're ever going to find peace within ourselves and peace within our world.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Really good. So tell people, and we're going to include links in the description for the podcast. So, you know, anybody that's listening, any links to get to the book, we'll include. But can you just tell, you know, verbally, how could someone find out more information? How can they buy the book? How could they read more about your story? How could they just kind of learn more?
Okay, thank you. So the book is entitled Quarks of Light, A Near-Death Experience, What I Saw That Opened My Heart. Mm-hmm. And they'll learn about a quark and why that's so important and what it is. But the book is available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And as the author, I had to use my middle initial, Rob A. Gentile, because there's some other Rob Gentiles out there. So, and you can also go to my website, which is robagentile.com. And they can learn more about me there. I have all my podcasts and blogs are on my website. And of course, there's also a link to Amazon to buy the book.
Awesome. Cool. Perfect. So is there anything I'm forgetting? Because I feel like you have so much, everything you've done is amazing. I feel like I've known you. I mean, we talked for the first time, like I said, a month ago, but I just feel like I've known you for much longer than that. And, I hope you know you're truly inspiring and doing, amazing things from, your personal life and everything, that you do for your daughter and writing the book and helping other patients. So
thank you.
It really is truly inspiring. And thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I'm excited to, keep in touch, follow your journey, read more of the book.
Awesome.
I appreciate you taking the time to be here with us today.
You bet. And I can tell you that if any of your listeners want to contact me, there's a contact page through my website. I'm happy to talk to anybody about their own personal journey. If I could be of help to anyone, I'm all about paying it forward. So I'd like to offer that to your listeners.
Awesome. That's great. Thanks, Rob.
You bet. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you so much for listening to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. If you like this episode, it would mean so much to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Like anything in life, the goal is to improve. Please provide any feedback you have, any topics you want to hear, or any guests that can provide value to our listeners. You can message us on Instagram at A Big Heart Podcast, or send us an email at mike@inaheartbeat.org. To learn more about In a Heartbeat and the programs we provide, please visit www.inaheartbeat.org. That is www.inaheartbeat.org.